morning is United States against Ellis. Ms. Kellum.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Chandra Kellum from the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois on behalf of the appellant. The only issue in this case is whether the district court plainly erred when it delegated its duty to establish the amount and timing of Mr. Ellis's fine payments while he was incarcerated to the Bureau of Prisons Inmate Financial Responsibility Program. This court has already answered yes to this question in United States v. Pandiello, and therefore so must this court.
Wasn't that a restitution case?
It was a restitution case, Your Honor, but in that case the court acknowledged that the district court has the duty to set the timing and the amount for fine payments as well, and it cannot delegate that duty. And that's what the court did here implicitly.
In what way did the court delegate any power? The executive branch can do what it wants with prison funds. The inmate responsibility program wasn't created by the court. It's not supervised by the court. It's run by the attorney general and the president. So I don't see what delegation there was here.
The way it delegated, Your Honor, is when it said in the order that the $3,000 fine was due and payable immediately, but he may pay it through the Inmate Financial Responsibility Program, when he said that, I'm sure he's not leaving the option to pay it up to the defendant, Mr. Ellis. He's given that decision to the
That's my question. He didn't give any power to the Attorney General that the Attorney General didn't have.
Well, Your Honor, it's...
He deleted that language from the judgment. It wouldn't affect the Attorney General's power in the slightest, so far as I can see.
You mean if it just said that it's due payable now, and then upon supervised release, they set up a payment plan?
If it just said, it's due and payable now, stop, right? The Attorney General's power to apply funds from the prisoner's account exists. It's a matter of the statutes giving the Attorney General and Bureau of Prisons the power to run the prison, right? So if the Attorney General can spend funds from that account for what the Attorney General thinks is responsible objects, I don't see anything's being delegated. Right? Your conception seems to be that the executive branch has only such powers as are delegated by judges, which I don't think is the way the Constitution sets up the structure of government.
Your Honor, that's not what I'm arguing. Let me clarify for a second. I think there's a difference between those line of cases when the court orders a fine or restitution due and payable immediately, like you're saying, and doesn't set up a payment schedule, from those cases where he purports to provide a payment schedule but leaves the details out and leaves it for someone else, another person, to decide later, and that's improper, and I am submitting that this case falls into that latter category. The court just didn't say $3,000 fine due and payable now. It purported to say, you know, he can pay it through this, while in jail, through his prison earnings, and then it set a definite payment plan upon supervised release. There's no evidence that he had the funds to pay it right then, so he had to pay it pursuant to this payment plan, and the court cannot leave the duty to specify the amount and the timing of those payment plans to any other person. That is strictly a judicial function, and that is language from this court's opinion in Pandiello.
Even assuming that there was error, why is the plain error test satisfied? And if you would also address the court's recent opinion in United States versus Tejeda on this issue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Which I think changes the legal landscape on plain error in this context.
I think it meets the plain error test for the same reason this court found it did in Pandiello, that the district court or the Article III judge has the sole authority to set the sentence. Part of the sentence could be a fine or restitution. In addition to the duty to set, if it orders a fine, it has the duty to establish how that fine is going to be paid, whether it's going to be paid immediately or whether it can be paid in installments. If it elects to make the decision to pay in installments.
Why is that sort of error one that affects the fundamental fairness, integrity, and public reputation of the proceedings?
Well, because it...
It's just a technical error.
This court said it's not...
The schedule can be modified, right?
It can be modified, Your Honor, but this court held in Pandiello, it's not a technical error.
Is that a good ruling, though, is my question?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. I agree with that ruling because it implicates our government. We have a separation of powers. The judge has the duty to set the sentence or decide the sentence, and the probation is supposed to carry it out. It cannot establish any part of the sentence. And
what's fundamentally unfair or lacking in integrity in that sort of error?
Well, in this circumstance, let's say that the Bureau of Prisons sets the payments, and let's say it says 100% of his earnings can go to this fine. This affects my client's substantial rights, because if he doesn't comply with that, he's then punished more severely in prison. He can be placed in a lower housing status and lose some of his privileges. So that's why it's important that this decision should be made by an Article III judge who has to take into account by statute his limited financial circumstances, his ability to pay his other financial obligations. And that's why this rises to the level of plain error, in my opinion.
Well, the opinion just issued a week or two ago in the Tejeda case stands for the proposition that the improper delegation of too much discretion over, in that case, drug testing during supervised release, too much discretion delegated to the executive branch, is not the sort of error that satisfies the plain error test and does not affect the fundamental fairness or integrity or public reputation of the proceedings.
Well, I see the drug testing different than paying a criminal fine, which is something the court can set at sentencing and can say, you know, depending on how much the defendant makes, if he makes $50, only a certain percentage should be paid towards that fine, as opposed to drug testing, which I can see why that would be more so under the Bureau of Prisons authority and trying to see if he's complying with the terms of probation, being drug-free, et cetera. I think in this case, again, the difference is you have a case, Pandiello, that's squarely on point, and this court's already held it. It rises to the level of plain error, and I'm only asking this court to follow Pandiello. If there are no further questions, I would like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly.
Thank you.
Ms. Hudson.
May it please the court, counsel. The court has brought up a good point. The Code of Federal Regulations allows for the Bureau of Prisons to run the Inmate Financial Responsibility Program. The court in this case, in this order, said specifically that the defendant shall pay any unpaid balances after release, using the word shall, and then there is a payment schedule that is in place. Prior to that, the district court said may be paid from prison earnings in compliance with the Inmate Financial Responsibility Program. Looking at those two sentences, we can look at the Code of Federal Regulations, which allows for the Inmate Financial Responsibility Program to be utilized, first of all, and secondly, looking at McGee versus Clark, which is a case which is directly on point. In that instance, an inmate objected to the financial responsibility program taking too much money out of his account. He did file an appeal. It is a prisoner appeal and not a direct appeal, but he did file an appeal asking the court to stop the prison from taking his money, in essence. The court found in that case that the district court at sentencing fully discharged its sentencing responsibilities by ordering the fine it imposed to be paid immediately. Therefore, the Bureau of Prison officials did not usurp the sentencing court's authority by establishing a payment schedule pursuant to the Inmate Financial Responsibility Program and then penalizing McGee for failing to accept it. Furthermore, there is no plain error in this case because, first of all, the court in this case did follow the law. The defendant did mention in the brief that was submitted United States versus Day, and I would like to address that because United States versus Day requires the district court to consider the defendant's ability to pay as it applies to restitution. If we even consider that regarding fines, in this instance, the court waived interest, finding the defendant could not pay it, did set a payment schedule once the defendant was to be released on supervised release, specifying $100 a month or 10% of gross income, and then allowed, pursuant to the Code of Federal Regulations and McGee versus Clark, the Inmate Financial Responsibility Program to basically take effect. The defendant in that case does have the option of complying or not complying. So the May allows for the reality that the defendant, Mr. Ellis, does not have to comply, so therefore there may be no payments made.
Ms. Hudson, let me understand that. So that the Bureau of Prisons couldn't during the period of incarceration take any monies? Is that your point?
During the period of incarceration, the financial responsibility program is optional. The defendant either accepts what the counselor gives him or he doesn't. If he does not accept that, as counsel stated, there will be sanctions. He will have lower prison bunk beds,
etc. Don't think that's a substantial impact on his status as an incarcerated person?
We don't usually describe this as optional, as in pay $10,000 or we'll drop you into a vat of boiling oil. It is not usually described as an optional payment of $10,000.
During the time that he's incarcerated, he has the option of selecting the worse punishment.
You want to run that by me again?
He has the option of not participating. Yeah. And they simply will designate him
as a pot of boiling oil.
Yeah.
They will simply designate him as non-compliant, and he will have certain sanctions. This court has issued another opinion, and I apologize, I've forgotten which one it was, that an inmate is not allowed or is not allowed to have as many candy bars as he would like while he's incarcerated. The goal is punishment and not every benefit that could possibly be had. But the ultimate point is the Code of Federal Regulations allows for this program to exist. Therefore, there is no usurping of power or improper delegation. Therefore, we ask that the court uphold the court's ruling. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Hudson. Anything further, Ms. Kellum?
Again, I think it's important to distinguish the difference between saying due and payable immediately and setting no payment plan, and then setting a payment plan and not specifying how that payment plan should be carried out, meaning the amounts and the timing. This case falls in the latter. As far as Day is concerned, that case was brought up in the brief for the proposition that when it's apparent the defendant can't pay the fine due and payable immediately, does the district court, by not setting a payment plan, implicitly delegate the duty to schedule the payments to probation? I just, again, respectfully request this court to follow Pandiello. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until tomorrow.